The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Football Weekly Extra.
Today, Napoli did it. Chelsea did it. Can Arsenal do it? That's beat Man City at the Etihad, of course, not signed Gianfranco Zola. Although, a big, big preview of the weekend in the Premier League on the way as we look forward to Spurs taking on Sunderland, Liverpool's trip to Aston Villa, and whether QPR can make Man United the most miserable group from Manchester since the Smiths. Elsewhere, we ask Sid what was that really important thing he was just about to tell us before that fire alarm went on Monday. We talk South Coast Derby, salute the last unbeaten side in the big European leagues, and preview Sunday's big showdown in Yokohama, Barca-Santos. Is Neymar really better than Messi? All of that with a liberal helping of posts and tweets in today's Football Weekly Extra. Hello, everybody, and thanks for joining us. Today, the vocal talents are Greg Ruffley.
Hi, James.
Paul McInnes.
Hello.
And Paolo Bandini.
Hello.
We'll be taking you through a preview of a busy, busy weekend. Busy, that's the word. Before we even get near the weekend, I have to say we have to look back on the events of Monday night. Monday night at Stamford Bridge. Woof. Woof, Paolo. Paul, did you see it?
Yeah, I did see
it. All right,
game,
then.
Yes.
What did you think?
I thought Chelsea played well. Second half, Man City looked to have slipped back into a slightly negative defensive mentality a little bit prematurely. Chelsea might not have scored had there not been the sending off. And in the end, I think they deserve to win the game.
Hey, Greg, Chelsea are back.
Well, yeah, I think Villas-Boas is starting to get... There seems to be a belief amongst the players now, which there maybe wasn't earlier on. And I don't think... I mean, it takes time for anybody to get their ideas across, particularly a manager who's, you know, he's only the same age as a lot of the players who have got huge egos who are in the Chelsea dressing room when he's come in there. So I think now he's... The idea he had at Porto, where they played high-tempo football, a mixture of, you know, short and more direct passing is coming through in Chelsea's play. And I mean, Chelsea... The people who were questioning Villas-Boas and, you know, whether he should be sacked, I mean, it's idiotic. I mean, like, to be considering that after 8 or 9 games, I mean, you've got to look at a manager over a season at the very least to see what he can do, particularly someone as young as him.
Now, all sorts of things to discuss in the aftermath of that. Arsenal clearly don't have brave, courageous, classy Frank Lampard ready to come off the bench and rescue the game, but can they do something similar?
I think they can, yeah. I mean, I think the idea when you're playing City, and this has been shown in games against Napoli, against Chelsea, to some extent against Liverpool, is, and I mean, even against QPR when they were away and they won 3-2, is that you don't be inhibited against City, because they've conceded in the last 8 games. In every game they've conceded a goal, so the defence isn't perhaps, you know, as strong as people might imagine it to be.
I'm not sure that Arsenal are necessarily that team that they've been in past years, who are going to flood forward and play in quite the same. I think that's one of the interesting things.
They're not going to sit back,
though, are they? No, obviously they're not going to sit back. But I do think that the game, I think it's one of the sort of interesting effects of what's happened with bringing in these more experienced players over the summer. I do think that it's a slightly more balanced game that Arsenal have been playing this year, and it's had its downsides as well. I think they maybe have lost a little bit of the verve and the flair that has been there in the last couple of seasons. But what they have got is a sense of stability and a sense of being able to grind out a tight result. If you look at the results they've had lately, they've been quite a lot of them only won by one goal, and games which, when you think about last season and those collapses they were having at the end of games, are games which you think might have got away from them, and maybe it's a slightly different team in that way. I still think it's a very tall order to go to City and beat them. I almost think that the fact that City have lost this game is going to make it an even taller one.
Paolo, how much should we read into two previous results? One, the 3-0 victory that Arsenal had at the as was the City of Manchester Stadium last season, and more recently the 1-0 victory that City had against Arsenal at the Emirates.
Well, I think last season you were looking at a sending off that changed that game very early on. You could talk about the sending off changing the game for Chelsea at the weekend. In that game, City were down to 10 early on and Arsenal were a goal up. And so it was a particular situation, I think, in that last trip to East Lands as it then was. I'm not sure you can read too much into that because it's also completely different teams now. You look at the players who were influential for Arsenal that day. Sami Nasri, I believe, had a really important performance that day for Arsenal. And obviously now he's warming City's bench. So
what about the League Cup defeat in the quarterfinal a couple of weeks ago?
What's interesting about that is that actually Arsenal played very well in that game. I think I wouldn't be alone in saying that I came away from that game with the sense that Arsenal very easily could have won, and funnily enough with a team that you looked at and thought was significantly weaker than the one that City had put out.
No Robin van Persie that night?
No, and perhaps that was the difference, because if they had maybe someone who could put the ball in the net, that would have been the difference between playing well and failing to score and failing well and scoring.
All right, so basically this trip to Manchester unlikely to finish 8-2, you
think? Well, I think the whole 8-2, that whole game, if you look at it, it was a very particular game. They're obviously, I know there are players missing this time, but there was a lot of players missing in the middle of the park. You had players like Coquelin starting, who actually played very well that day. But really, for me, when that game got completely out of hand, it was a game that Arsenal were losing and losing comfortably already by this point. But when it really got out of hand was right at the end of the game, when Wenger sort of threw caution to the wind and just threw on extra bodies and took Coquelin out of midfield and had no one protecting his defence anymore. And I don't think, having been burned like that, were his team to be losing away to City, he would perhaps make quite such reckless substitutions, just because it might be a damaging blow to go through that sort of defeat again if it was happening.
All right, Paul McGinnis is saying a home win.
No, I think so, yeah. I think Man City for the title still.
I think probably I still expect City to win, but I don't think it's going to be... I certainly don't expect a game like that one at United. I think it's going to be a much more... Again, I think if you look at how Arsenal have been playing, they're much more contained than they were in that day at Old Trafford. I think it's going to be a much tighter game than that.
Even without any of the left-backs. Okay.
For all that I've said, Arsenal are going to... You know, the team that could attack them. I'll go 1-1 then. I will go 1-1. Yeah.
So nice.
Yeah. But I didn't really... You know, they have got a lot of injuries at the back, Arsenal as well. So.
Chelsea, meanwhile, will be looking to continue their extraordinary run of successes with a win at Wigan. A glance back into the record book shows that they came away with a 6-0 victory in their last trip to the DW. That's handy. Of course, there are one or two... Sorry, Paul.
No, I was just marvelling at your research skills there.
Yeah. 6-0 last season.
I think they'll win, won't they, Chelsea?
You'd think.
Yeah, despite this amazing newfound determination amongst the Wigan side not to get turned over every single
week. Well, they're on a one-game winning streak, are they not? Yeah. One or two questions about Chelsea. I did enjoy the back page on one of the tabloids yesterday suggesting Torres for sale for 20 million, presumably all nearest offer written underneath. But they've got a problem building, haven't they? And we talked about Villas-Boas getting his ideas across, but there is a question here because he's frozen Anelka out of the team. Anelka's he's now confirmed he's going to Shanghai in January. Torres isn't scoring. Okay, Drogba is. But isn't Drogba and Kalou, aren't they heading off to the Africa Cup of Nations very, very soon? Unless my research has gone completely wrong. So there's a major problem there. Wouldn't they have needed Anelka potentially there?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's the right thing to do to sell Anelka strategically. It was probably the right thing to do to let Drogba go strategically. But he is by far their most convincing striker. He looks like the Drogba of a couple of years ago at the moment. Now, people might say that's because he's playing a negotiating game for a new contract, what happens after that, la la la. But if he goes, you really don't have anybody who's been playing right down the centre, because Sturridge has been playing out wide for them. Mm-hmm. Torres is out of form. So it's almost like, is Abramovich going to back Villas-Boas with another 30 million in the transfer window? Is that what they're thinking?
What, to cover while Drogba's away now?
Well, I think to buy another striker so that in the summer, either Drogba goes up.
He goes
into the team then as well. You get that too. Okay.
I think this could be this is Torres' big opportunity in January to, you know, I don't think they'll sell him in January, but if Drogba is not around the, you know, parading around Stamford Bridge, giving it the big I am, perhaps now Torres might feel a little bit less inhibited
and missed the opportunity. Might come out of his, I mean, they were kind of getting a bit out of both strikers early on the season before Torres had his suspension, and you feel that he's not played for so long now that if everybody accepts that there's at least a partly psychological explanation for him not being where he is, Is he going to come back into that team in January and instantly hit the ground running?
Well, I think if a striker knows they're going to have like six starts on the bounce, you know, and then there's not really much danger of them being benched, then I think that's where you get the best out of them. And, you know, I just think that's what generally happens with strikers.
All right, well, big questions looming then for the Blues. Meantime, heading back to this weekend, I mentioned that City could be second by the time they take the field against Arsenal.
So we're not going to leave that game behind without mentioning Ashley Cole, are we?
Oh, no, sorry. Mention Ashley Cole.
I just, you know, it seems like it would be a remiss of us. So he's supposedly, when he was heading down into the tunnel with the City players, made a jibe along the lines of Thursday night's Channel 5,
right,
and may have stirred up a little bit of bother.
Which I take exception to, is if there's something wrong with A, broadcasting on a Thursday, and B, appearing on Channel 5. I mean, this, for me, is pretty much the pinnacle of my career. And
That's viral marketing for the channel, is it not? I mean, that's probably the best press they've had in years.
All right, a bit like Chris Hoy.
Chris Foy.
Or Chris Hoy.
Or Chris Foy.
Yeah, we'll come back onto that conundrum a little bit later on, because right now I want to go back to that Man United game away to QPR. It's a fixture which saw Chelsea lose, but that is, curiously, the only victory that QPR have had at home so far this season. So what's going to happen here, Paul McGuinness?
I think Man United will turn them over.
Really?
I wonder about QPR. I think they've got a good technical side, but I'm not sure that the combative mentality, which I think is probably going on inside and outside the dressing room, is necessarily conducive to success.
Here's words I thought I'd never say. Joey Barton's being a bit quiet, isn't he?
Well, yes, but what I hear is that Joey Barton doesn't like at least two or three core members of the squad already, and there is you've already got this situation where Adel Taarabt is just essentially frozen out of the squad, which is a... You know, last year, what Warnock managed to do, which was most impressive, was to get something out of Taarabt, get him contributing to the side. I'm not sure you can afford to, A, as QPR, lose that amount of talent from your squad, because your squad isn't that strong. And secondly, what other signals is he sending out if he's not on the pitch?
But isn't it true that Joey Barton doesn't like two or three people in any given room?
Depends how many people are in the room. I suppose if there's two, he might be able to fabricate a third.
He's also listening to Bon Iver a lot at the moment, can make you reflective and quiet, you know.
All
afterwards.
Right, fair enough. I didn't know that. Are you following, Joey?
I saw him mention, you know, some lyrics from the song Holocene the other day, which is a beautiful song. And
what's it about, Greg?
It's about longing for, you know, your childhood and the memories of your past, and the fact that when you're a child, you think, you know, the world's endless, and when you grow up, it's not.
Mm. That's the thing that's made me stop following Joey Barton when he started calling people maggots all the time.
Oh, right. Okay. Is that another Bon Iverism?
No,
it's not really his thing, is it?
Yeah. It's a very natural world.
Well, I'm not going to leave this game without mentioning the very unfortunate business with Darren Fletcher. It sounds awful for him. Was it ulcerative colitis? But really, really irritable bowel kind of...
And irremedial bowel syndrome.
Irremedial?
Well, it has been going on for a long time, and I think these, from what little I know, intestinal conditions can be very complicated.
Well, they can be really, really painful as well, and debilitating, and he's going to be out of the game indefinitely.
Yeah.
Greg, rotten news for him. Obviously bad news in sporting terms for Man United, but you raised the question of, this has been something they've known about for some time.
Yeah, they've known about this since last season. And if they knew about this, then in the summer I would have thought a central midfielder would have been a priority, particularly with Scholes retiring. The fact that United didn't buy a central midfielder suggests that perhaps, you know, there really is a financial issue there with the Glazers. And it'd be interesting to see in January what kind of player Ferguson goes for, how much he spends. You know, he could... I mean, what they need is, they need a player, you know, who's as good as Bastian Schweinsteiger, who can do everything. I mean, that's the kind of player in the past, you know, Manchester United would have gone for. But, I imagine now they might have to shop below that kind of player because they haven't got Champions League football to offer. And if Ferguson hasn't got, you know, the money that he needs to buy a replacement, then I think they might struggle. I mean, they're probably going to be looking at, you know, players who might not have been thought up to it in the past.
This was a conversation that Rob and Philippe had on the pod the other day, and you know, Rob was making some really good points, basically that United's net transfer spend over the last few years is right there with sort of Stoke and Sunderland. It's not, they haven't been spending big money, and that really is, it does look like the issue. Again, I'm as surprised as everyone else is they didn't address this, but then perhaps I think it actually does just prove this point that Rob was trying to make, that they really are keeping a very tight control on money. And it was funny because I was asked to help out with making this gallery, which went up on The Guardian yesterday, of 16 transfer targets for Manchester United, supposedly. And these were all the names that have been linked in the tabloids, are the ones that sort of went into the gallery. But half of them you look at and you think, well, come on now, they're not about to pull out the 40 million you'd need to get Götze or Schweinsteiger or someone like that. But, you know, there's a couple on there that you think maybe are a bit more realistic. Maybe someone like Rodwell because of Everton's financial situation.
Like Dembele at Fulham maybe as well.
Yeah. And I think
the
most interesting one for me actually, and obviously this is to do with my own biases towards Serie A as well, I guess, but I the one who's interesting to me is Daniele De Rossi, because he really is in a situation right now where he's 18 months from the end of a contract and he isn't, you know, he isn't making noises at the moment that he would, that he definitely wouldn't move away from Roma, even though it's been his club forever and it's the club that he adores. With the new ownership coming in, with new management, maybe it's a time when he feels like it's not as much the Roma that he grew up in. And also, he hasn't got this contract signed. He wants more money. The only thing is, he does want money, and yeah. I don't know if United would give him that money.
He won't leave Roma. This is a city that makes you fall in love with it every day. As he tweeted only 2 days ago.
I saw that. Look,
he wasn't talking about Manchester.
I'm not saying that he's definitely on his way out. And I think that you won't find many people who have an affection for a team stronger than him and Francesco Totti do there for a team and a city, I think, more to the point. But at the same time, I just think the way these negotiations have been going in Rome, I really don't think it's any foregone conclusion that he stays. I don't think that Roma are about to offer him what he thinks he's worth. Now, if United would, is a different question, but I don't think he's about to get what he thinks he's worth in Roma.
But it's a two-part problem, isn't it, for United, in that finding the 40 million to buy Götze or whatever is one thing, but then finding the wages that are going to attract. And I wonder, because it's not like United haven't spent big price tags on players, you know, Phil Jones, Ashley Young, David De Gea, all in this summer. But I suspect that generally their wages are coming in at quite an affordable level for United.
All right then. Crikey, there's so much still to discuss. We'll try and squeeze it all into the next two parts, which feature imminently Sid Lowe with the rest of Monday's conversation from Spain. Right, much to discuss in part two, especially with that Club World Cup coming up, underway at the moment indeed. Let's now dial up our man in Spain, Sid Lowe. Hi, Sid.
Hi, James. How you doing?
Very, very well. And yourself?
Not too bad, thank you.
Great news. Barcelona are on the telly at the moment, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. I've only just got in. I must admit, I was out. Leo Messi just over and kicked it wide of the post. It was 2-0 when I walked in. Barcelona just scored the third. Seydou Keita got it. So I must confess, I can't tell you very much more about the game because I've only been watching it for a couple of minutes. But there is really bad news, James.
Oh.
It's been confirmed that David Villa has broken his tibia, has a fracture of the tibia. Now, of course, it would depend on the extent of that fracture, whether it's a split, because we were told, I'm trying to remember which game it was. I think it might have been the game in the Copa del Rey against Hospitalet, when Guardiola said that Villa had a very slight crack in his tibia. And I wonder if this is a continuation of that or a different injury. So, of course, the extent of that crack or break or however, you know, whatever kind of fracture it is will make a difference as to how long he's likely to be out for. But of course, if it is bad, then we could be talking about 6 months and we could be talking about him missing the European Championships.
All right. Where were you, Sid?
I was actually going around the Spanish Football Federation Museum, which is wonderful. And it was a little bit sad doing it because I walked around completely on my own. I didn't see another person there. I thought, what a brilliant museum for there to be no one there is such a pity.
What was the most interesting or surprising thing you saw in the Spanish Football Federation Museum, Sid?
Well, none of it was particularly surprising, but it's amazing seeing some of the older stuff is really great. And of course, probably the best kind of individual piece that they've got there is last year's Copa del Rey, last year's Spanish Copa del Rey. And they've got the Copa del Rey from the actual one that was handed out last year. And of course, for those who remember last year's Copa del Rey final, and in particular the celebrations that came after, this is the Copa del Rey that Sergio Ramos dropped from the top deck of the open top bus, underneath the wheels, the bus ran it over. And the Federation have put it in their museum without fixing it. So they've got this mangled Copa del Rey, which is quite a nice little touch.
Yeah, very evocative. On Monday, we were having a bit of a chat when the fire alarm went off. Just as you were saying, of course, the one thing that gets forgotten all of this, and the one thing that's really important is... And what was
I don't know, James, because I don't know what I was saying before that. What was the context?
Well, okay,
what
we
was
were
I saying
talking,
at the time?
All right, we were talking about Mourinho. I was saying, what is the damage going to be to Mourinho? No real excuses this time around. No real story he can play on to deflect attention from the fact that his team weren't good enough. Although there is that hint of the maybe it was going to be a red card for Messi until the referee realised it was Messi. But you said, yeah, there are issues. You know, Mourinho's relationship with his players isn't really always as good as it's cracked up to be, and maybe there's one or two problems developing there. But, of course, the big thing that really doesn't get talked about in this is, and then, you know, the fire alarm.
Oh, crikey. I'm trying to think back and think, what was I thinking when I was...
Well, tell us about Mourinho's relationship with players, because I was interested in that.
One of the things that Mourinho's done very well this year, I think, is be intelligent enough to listen to his players at the moment at which it looked like things might go quite badly wrong, which was after the Racing Santander game. I wouldn't go so far as to call it a confrontation, but there was a discussion in the dressing room after the game in which essentially some of the players made it clear to Mourinho that the kind of constant tension wasn't good for them. The moaning about referees and the kind of pressure it was putting on them wasn't good for them. And the discourse in England was always that Mourinho brings loads of pressure on himself to try and release his players from pressure. That he creates, you know, he starts fires everywhere so that people can be putting those fires out and not worrying about the players. And the players live very relaxed. At Real Madrid, the opposite has been true. Certainly at key moments, there have been times when the players have felt more pressure than ever because of the way that Mourinho's handled things, and also because Mourinho's behaviour and handling of their rivals, in this case Barcelona, has been slightly different from the way that he did it at some of his clubs, both in England and in Italy. After that Racing Santander game, there was, a kind of a slight change in Mourinho, and there was a desire to foster a bit more unity, because there was a sense from some of the players that Mourinho wasn't entirely even-handed with them. And I think Mourinho handled that really quite well. He did take a step back. He was that little bit more humble. And he did sort of, if you like, try and ease some of those kind of slight tensions in the dressing room. And, of course, Madrid keep on winning because they're a very good side, because a lot of the work that Mourinho does is very, very good indeed. And they keep on winning. And they start to play a slightly different style, which is in part based on the fact that Mourinho has listened to his players and wants to be a little bit more expansive, partly because they do, partly because he allows a little bit of latitude.
Sid, I was just sort of wondering, obviously with Barcelona being halfway around the world, how does the Madrid press handle this week? I mean, you're back to playing in the league, but it's not the Clásico, and it sort of doesn't matter even though you're top of the league, and it, to a certain extent, obviously it does matter, they've got to win, but I don't know, does it feel flat? Does it feel...
Yeah, it does feel a bit flat. What they've really done, certainly the Madrid-based media, is kind of make it so that you say that the league doesn't matter, sort of, because Barcelona's away. And I would, broadly speaking, agree with you. But what they've done is they've talked about it in terms of the league does matter. That, you know, Barcelona are away, so winning this weekend against Sevilla. And by the way, in theory at least, Sevilla is one of the hardest trips for Madrid this season. But by winning away in Sevilla, Madrid will go 3 points clear again. Mourinho has talked about how he's won was 16 in a row, I think it was, going into the Clásico, which equals the record of Miguel Muñoz. So it's talking about this is still a very good team. And I think they'd be right, by the way, to insist that you shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. They're right to insist that a lot of things are done very, very well and shouldn't be thrown out because of the Clásico.
Here's one follow-on to that. I mean, if Real Madrid were to go on to win the league this season, but they failed, you know, they lost all their games against Barcelona, how would that be perceived?
That's a really good question. It's one I've asked as well, and as you can imagine, the response has been different from different people. But if Real Madrid, let's say for argument's sake, they go and lose the second Clásico at the Camp Nou and win the league, which is perfectly plausible. In fact, I would say it's almost quite likely, because you know they will continue to beat the vast majority of the other teams. If they win this weekend, they'll still have a 3-point lead, so they would only effectively need Barcelona to drop 1 point over the course of the season, 1 point comparatively to them.
Sid, a couple of quick questions. One, the Villa injury, does that mean that whole Villa to Chelsea or Villa to wherever Villa was supposed to be going to story is thrown out the window?
Well, it's thrown out the window, but to be honest, it should have probably been thrown out the window anyway.
Really? Okay.
In the very least, the Villa going during the winter transfer window wasn't on the cards. Now, I personally think Villa going in the summer was, very definitely was. I actually think that Villa was, at the very least, they're open to the idea of a departure in the summer, but not in the winter transfer window.
Oh, okay, but now he's broken his tibia.
But
anyway.
Now, in any case, yeah, exactly.
Okay. Now, the other thing is the World Clubs Cup, in which, if all other results go as expected, they will be taking on Santos this Sunday morning. And there is a bit of a Real Barca element here as well, because most people, well, certainly Madrid, reckon that Neymar's next destination is indeed Real Madrid. I know supposedly he turned down a move there last summer. Having said that, the Catalan press have been full of stories of Neymar going to Barcelona as well. So what's the latest in Spain on that?
Yeah, I'm glad you said that. People in Madrid think he's going to Madrid. They don't anymore.
Oh.
There's a belief that the way that he handled the renegotiation of his contract with Santos and the way he's talked since suggests that he's given the old nudge-nudge, wink-wink to Barcelona. Ooh. Now, quite honestly, I don't know the answer to that, but it does feel like the air has moved slightly around him, the kind of things he's saying and doing, and the reaction to it seems to me to have shifted a little bit. And I honestly don't know where he'll end up, but where at one point it seemed very clear that he was going to Real Madrid, and Real Madrid as a club were I think quite confident that they were going to get him. I think Real Madrid feel a bit played by both him and by the Santos president.
Sid, I know I should really know this, but how good is Neymar?
Well, you say you should know it. I think we should all know it, but we don't really, because we're...
Pele knows it.
Well, Pele doesn't know shit, does he? Let's face it.
Pele said he's better than Messi. Listen, this
Pele
is the guy...
Pele said Colombia were going to win the World Cup.
He said Nicky Butt was going
to be... going to win the World Cup. Pele goes to France and France are going to win the World Cup.
Right.
Pele tells us, honestly.
All right, Sid.
Calm yourself. It works as well.
Yeah. Anyway, moving along. Sid, thank you ever so much for that, and look forward to catching up with you on Monday.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Sid. Now, well, we're going to hear another opinion on the whole Neymar and indeed Santos Barca issue very, very shortly. Rupert Farrar from southamericanfootball.co.uk. But before we do that, let's just, what have we got? A couple of posts here. Did enjoy Ben Buff and his fire drill story. We had a fire drill on Monday. Ben Buff thought he had one. Terrific story.
Is Buff in inverted commas or is that
his surname? I don't know. But he'd had one on the Friday. On Monday, he turned up and loads of people milling outside his building. And so he decided, instead of going to his usual muster point or whatever those things are called, he just hung around with them and kind of said, incredible, this 2 days in a row. And they said, well, when? He said, we had one on Friday at 5:30. They said, well, we left at 4. So then, when the fire alarm finished and they all went to the lift, he was just astounded that nobody else, there wasn't the usual stampede to get back into the office. He was the only one. And then he realised he's actually been part of somebody else's fire drill. Hilarious story, Ben. Thanks for that. Hey.
Buff luck.
What?
Buff luck there.
Is that an expression?
Like tough luck.
Oh, I see. Thanks, Paul, for that. Don't cut that, guest producer Matt. Let's let that stay in there for everyone to hear. I tell you what, lots of people posting about Italy this week. Blunt Guardian says, AC Jimbo in the City, can we find some love for Miro Klose? A big game for Lazio and Klose this week. They're taking on top of the table Udinese.
Yeah, top of the table Udinese, who unfortunately Lazio will start a goal down against, in the words of Alberto Pelosky, because you start every game against Udinese goal down because Di Natale always scores.
Right, well, he certainly does.
He's got 67 in his last 84 Serie A games, which is quite a rate.
He's top of the table again in the goal-scoring charts.
He is, as he has been for the last 2 years.
All right, well, also in Serie A, Inter moved up to seventh with their win away to Genoa. What the what?
I know.
They were down on the edge of the relegation.
I know. It's a wonder what going five games without defeat will do for you. They've picked things up and they're moving back in the right direction. And I don't know. I think there's been a lot of, it's the same as with Chelsea. Obviously, their start has been worse than Chelsea's was. But the same way that people have slightly overreacted to Villas-Boas, I think people were all too ready to start damning Ranieri when he couldn't fix a bad situation. And it has been a bad situation there, which is more to do with the board than anything else. The club has been quite poorly run through this period when they've won the treble. It's been run in a very short-termist way and they've set themselves up for this trouble. They've then brought in a manager this summer who was appointed apparently by, sticking pins in a list of randomly assorted manager names, and then they failed to back him when they appointed him a manager who plays 3-4-3. They failed to bring in any players to assist him. There's been lots of bad decisions made, so it was always going to take a bit of time to turn around.
All right.
But they're doing okay.
Well, they're doing okay now. Not quite as well as Juventus, though, who remain, as I mentioned back at the start, the only unbeaten side, or who are now the only unbeaten side in the major European leagues. Now, there is Dynamo Kiev and two in Portugal, Benfica and Porto, haven't lost yet this season. But out of, the big ones, Germany, Spain, England and Italy, just Juventus, and they stay unbeaten thanks to a 1-1 draw on Monday at the Stadio Olimpico against Roma, a game which left both sides with some regrets.
Yeah, it was a sort of hard one to know who should feel happier about, because obviously Juventus had been a goal down and Totti had a penalty saved, so in that regard they may have come away from it thinking, well, actually getting a draw is not such a bad way to leave. We're unbeaten after 14 games, the first time ever in 3 points for a win they've managed that. But equally, Roma came into that game with just a ridiculous list of injuries.
Nine potential first teamers were out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. With injury suspension, the back line they had to draft. They had to pull De Rossi back in there. Where actually he did really well.
He was a phenomenal. No?
Yeah, but obviously in doing that you have to take him out of midfield. So they had to promote Viviani from the youth team as the captain of the youth team, and he had an okay game actually. But there was a lot going on with that Roma team, missing the top three centre backs. So it was a game which you looked at on paper and thought, well, they've got to. This is only going to go one way. So in that sense, it was a surprising and good result for Roma to get anything. But having been a goal up and then had that penalty at 1-1, they also leave it feeling a little bit frustrated.
Right. What about this big story in the Italian papers at the moment saying that Juventus have come in for Carlos Tevez?
There's a great quote from Clarence Seedorf in this morning's Gazetta, which was perhaps not the cleverest way of inviting a player to your team, because obviously Berlusconi was challenging him and saying, come here and you can win the Ballon d'Or, he said this morning, and if you come to us, it's about the football, whereas PSG is about the money. But Seedorf phrased that in a subtly different way, which was, if he chooses Milan, it'll be the first time in his career he's chosen football over a contract.
Yeah.
Which I think possibly was not the
most
welcoming
way to.
Yeah, well, perhaps it's an interesting story, and it slightly surprises me just because what Conte has built in Turin is really a team based around a lack of egos. The whole point of it is a team built for team ethic first and foremost, and everyone pulling in the same direction. And perhaps Tevez does not have a reputation as a guy who would fit into such a dressing room.
Really? He's just told a magazine back in Argentina that he'd like to go to pre-season with Boca Juniors and play the Libertadores with them. I don't care if I lose money, Tevez is quoted as saying. I'm tired of travelling and going back and forth. I'm not coming back to England. It does sound the ideal man to be splashing out $25 million or so on. Well, a man who might have a view on that, and indeed that subject we were talking about just before, the World Clubs Cup, Clubs World Cup, is Rupert Fryer from SouthAmericanFootball.co.uk. Who joins us now on the line. Rupert, hello, thanks for joining us.
Hello, James, thanks for having me.
Not at all. So, the big Neymar debate is raging here in the studio. Paul McInnes has got Paolo Bandini by the throat. They're rolling around on the floor. He's better than Messi, says Paul McInnes. Paolo insists Messi's got the edge. What do you think? What's the view there at SouthAmericanFootball.co.uk?
Well, I think our view is probably Pele recently said that Neymar's better than Messi. I think we can all take that to mean Messi is probably a better player.
Yes, indeed. All right, Sid Lowe was saying that there's a fear in Spain that this Neymar bloke, for all his amazing play, and he certainly looked great against Kashima, whatever they're now called. Mm-hmm. Used to be Kashima Antlers, but what do they call that? Kashima Reysol, there you go. He did look fantastic in that game, but that he might just be the kind of the new Robinho. Your thoughts?
No, I wouldn't say so. He's had some of the same problems that Robinho's had, in as much as his temperament and his attitude on the pitch. But I think the most important thing that you see with Neymar is that with every major game, he seems to always be improving. And not only that, but he seems to be learning as well. He's always learning. He seems to learn from his mistakes. Probably one example of that came in the first leg of a Libertadores final last year, where he really did get the hell kicked out of him. But he wasn't necessarily as effective as he probably wanted to be in that game, but he remained calm, he kept playing.
Well, he certainly has a brilliant record for Brazil. Of course, the media's turned Sunday's game into a real Neymar-Messi showdown. But what about the Santos team in general?
It's a huge, huge, huge game, really, I think, this for Santos. I think, as we all know, this competition is seen as a lot more important, I think, by the South American clubs as it is perhaps by those in Europe. And it's a huge game, in as much as it's something they've been preparing for probably 6 months, really. Since winning Libertadores in June, they pretty much took their foot off the pedal, coasted through the domestic championship. I think they finished 10th, about halfway up in the end. They never really bothered. Their only real concern there was to avoid relegation and prepare themselves for this game. So that's what they've been doing. They're going into their centenary next year, which, again, is a huge, huge deal for Brazilian clubs, for South American clubs in general. And I think to kick it off with this title would be a huge deal for them.
All right. There are question marks over their form at the back defensively.
Yes, there were. There were lots, actually, yesterday, from the Brazilian media. which Coach Maurizio Jamalo didn't necessarily take too kindly to. Their insinuation was, their accusation rather, was that Santos didn't really defend very well, especially at left back, where the veteran Leao, who usually slots in there, wasn't available. And so the centre-back Duval filled in at left full-back. But yeah, most of the problems seemed to come in the second half from Santos's left side. And so that was seen as a problem. Romelu didn't necessarily, as I said, didn't necessarily take too kindly to it. He was rather irritated, actually. I think he said, this is what it's like in Brazil. You guys, you're always complaining. If we defend well, you say we don't attack well. If we attack well and score goals, then we haven't defended well. Mm. However, he then did qualify that by saying, yes, we do need to improve a little bit defensively against Barcelona, because obviously they have much much more talented individuals.
Yeah, I'll say. Rupert, what do you think? Can they beat Barca? Who's your money on?
I think they can. I don't necessarily think they will. Romelu, he's talked a lot about Barcelona over the last few months, while expressing caution, of course, that they had to get through their semi-final first. But having done that, a lot of the talk coming into the tournament, he's been saying, in fact, he described Santos as the complete opposites of Barcelona, he said. He's quite a studious coach, Romelu. He's watched a lot of Barcelona over the past few years, and he said, coming in, he said that he saw Manchester United and Real Madrid try to get more possession of the ball than Barcelona, and they failed. He said that's something we have to make sure we don't try and do. He's trying to convey to the players that they need to remain patient, and that if you try and get more possession of the ball than Barcelona, you'll just fail. And not only will you fail, but you'll be unable to play your own game. So he said, we're not about possession, we're about attacking with urgency and with pace. And so that is basically what they're going to try and do, I think. They're going to not necessarily be overly defensive, not necessarily into Milan as they did in that Champions League, but he said that they're going to have to remain patient, remain rigid, remain disciplined, and then they're going to have to convert. Whenever they do win the ball, they're going to have to convert the ball into attack extremely quickly. All and right. For me, I think the most important player in that regard is going to be the playmaker, Paulo Henrique Ganso. Neymar's obviously the talent of the team, but Ganso is the real brains of that club, the real brains of that side, I think. An example came yesterday when, I think it was a third goal, Danilo's free kick. Originally, Ganso was going to take the free kick, but he said, Danilo was speaking yesterday, and he said, oh, Ganso looked, and he said, there's a huge space, and even though it's probably better for me as a left foot, if you whip it around the outside of the wall, I think you'll score, and he did. So Ganso, I think, is very much the brains, and he's going to be extremely important, because I think when Santos do get the ball on a few occasions, they do perhaps manage to nick it, he's going to be the one who's going to have to convert that defensive possession into attack extremely quickly. And so it's going to be a huge, huge test for him, I think. He's been hyped to the skies, as Neymar was, but he seems to have struggled whenever he's made that little step up. He was disappointed in the Copa America, and so I think Sunday will be a huge, huge day for him.
Brilliant. Rupert, fantastic stuff. I'm really looking forward to this game now. Many thanks for joining us, and look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Yeah, anytime. Thanks.
Thanks, Rupert. What time is this game on in your time zone, Greg?
It's 10:30 in the morning.
In UK time in...
In Tunbridge Wells for me at the moment, yeah.
Right, okay,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Right, with the in-laws.
Great stuff. Let's wrap up part two with that. And in part three, we're looking forward to some of the other sizzlers that are on their way over this sensational weekend. Part three. So many top games came out this weekend. We heard about that biggie over in Japan. But down on the south coast of little old England, there's a bit of a sizzler as well. Isn't there, Paul McInnes?
Yes, certainly.
I've come
it's
to you.
It's the south coast. Yeah, it's South Coast Derby, because it shows that great football exists outside of the top four of the Premiership.
Correcto.
Or whatever.
Yeah. Outside the top four of the Championship as well, because I know Southampton are top, but where are Pompey?
Pompey, I couldn't give you a precise...
16th.
16th, sorry. Yeah.
It is Southampton against Pompey, or rather I should say Portsmouth-Southampton, and it's a big game this one, isn't it, Greg? Special arrangements for it.
Yeah, apparently the police have decided to create this, what they're calling a security bubble, a coach bubble, and Southampton fans can only go to the match if they board a bus in Southampton, where they'd be given a ticket to go directly to the ground and go into the match. Now, they say this is to
prevent trouble. Which
the
is,
police launched their own coach line. They're just trying to.
Well, possibly, yeah, yeah, you know, yeah. Well, I don't know, what probably like big yellow buses with you know, Hampshire Police written on the side of them, yeah, or something. Well, I mean, that's what the Saints fans are very unhappy because they think they're being treated, you know, like criminals rather than like football supporters. Mm-hmm. And I mean, some of the rhetoric that the superintendent's used maybe suggests that as well. By he's mentioned the disasters like Bradford, Hillsborough, and he's mentioned Heysel and also Ibrox in terms of talking about disorder. And I mean, you could say yes, that's true in the case of Heysel. It's a very dangerous road when you start to equate crowd safety issues with busing fans in. You know, because once they're inside the ground, that's where these disasters have happened, inside the ground. Busing them straight into the ground is purely and simply about, you know, stopping what they believe is criminal activity, which a lot of those fans say, well, we're, you know, it's a very small minority that go to the match and cause trouble, and we should be able to go to a match, you know, very freely and attend. And I think they're right. You know, I have got some sympathy with them, but although they are going to do the same for Portsmouth fans, it's not just Southampton fans.
Well, they're going to make them go to Southampton and then get
that'd work well, wouldn't it? Yeah, but they're going to do it the other way around as well. So
Right, well, Southampton top of the table. I know you're all over the Championship.
I am.
What about Portsmouth then? Well, down in 16th in all sorts of trouble, almost going bust, owner in jail.
I mean, that's a long-running story that will surely continue for a time yet. I think there are signs of Michael Appleton, the new manager, who was plucked from relative obscurity, that he's turning a corner slightly. They've had a couple of good results the last weeks. And you know, Cotterill, for the lack of money he did have, he made some astute signings. I think David Norris has been delivering for them in the central midfielder they picked up from Ipswich. I'm going to completely pronounce his name wrong, but I think it's Hugelstad. It's another a Norwegian attacking midfielder they have, who's been getting on the goal sheet quite a lot. I think they've got experience, is what Pompey have. They've got a small squad, but they've got a strong, experienced first 11.
They've got a chance against Southampton at home as well, because for all that Southampton have been, you know, outstanding at home, they've won 21 games on the bounce and drew the last game to which they could have broke a record. But away from home, they've drawn three, they've lost four. So I mean, they can be got at away from home, particularly in, you know, what will be a very volatile atmosphere. With a new manager, Pompey might have a chance, might fancy it.
All right.
Can I just mention one other thing, football league related? Phil Brown was sacked at Preston. I mean, like, what next for Phil Brown? I wonder whether he's been slightly unlucky. A lot of Preston fans believe that Ridsdale's been brought in to cut costs because the owner, Trevor Hemmings, he said he's committed to Preston, but he's not, you know, so committed to spending money now. So he's brought Ridsdale in, and Ridsdale sacked Phil Brown. Now, that probably means they're going to have to appoint another manager who might want to buy more players, which I don't see that working very well. And Phil Brown, as much as he's had a terrible run recently, and they won one in 11 matches, he had a very good run at the beginning of the season, and I think this is another example of where maybe a manager could have been given to the end of the season before being judged, because he came in when they were in the Championship and was told, you know, keep us up, but they were about 10 points adrift at the time, which was never going to happen.
They were seven adrift, they finished six adrift.
Yeah, so yeah. I mean, yeah, he gained a point, you know. Yeah. But yeah, I just wonder whether he's been a little bit hard done by there. Maybe people will, you know, disagree with me, because a lot of people have strong opinions about Phil Brown.
All right, well, let's finish off by returning to the Premier League weekend. All sorts of games for the teams in trouble down the bottom. Blackburn are taking on West Brom. Matt Riley tweets, who will be sacked on Monday, Hodgson or Steve Keane? Well, I think neither possibly, but that's a big game, isn't it, Blackburn-West Brom? Mm. Yes, it is, says Paolo Bandi.
Indications are that Steve Keane isn't going to get sacked anytime soon, so I think that's probably wider the mark, even if they were to lose, but it's certainly a big game in terms of...
They keep on making bad mistakes. I mean, you know, as a Norwich fan, I can't talk, but Blackburn, week in, week out, making bad mistakes, and that ultimately does... The manager has to accept responsibility for that, ultimately.
Your lot are at Goodison Park.
Yeah. Yeah, it's you know, last weekend was a good result, and we really did a number on Newcastle. But I think they phrased it in the Daily Mail as that's now two wins in seven for Norwich, which is another way of looking at it, which is not entirely great. So I think a lot of people will be going to Goodison, you know, hopeful. QPR did them on the opening day of the season. There's trouble in at Mill around Goodison, and it may be good for us, but who knows? My brother got a sneaky question in on the Telegraph internet web chat with Henry Winter. He said, how good is Paul Lambert? Henry Wentz said, very, very good.
There you go. There you go. More confirmation for you. Fulham are taking on Bolton. Fulham, of course, reeling from the shock exit at the hands of Odiadince in the top Europa League. But they are at home to Bolton.
Yeah, and Fulham are playing very well. You know, they are playing good football. They left a few players out last night, which maybe, you know...
Yeah, Martin Yeo waging war on his team again.
yeah, exactly. But, I mean, Fulham have played very good football. Bolton have been abject this season in most of the games they've played, and apart from when they had that bizarre result against Stoke at home.
And the bizarre result away to QPR as well.
Well, yeah, oh yeah, right at the beginning of the season. But yeah, but other than that, they have been... It doesn't seem to be anything to them, regardless of all their injuries they've had. I can't see any other winner than Fulham in that game.
Even without their injuries, Bolton have a really poor squad. I mean, Zach Knight is a first-choice centre-half for them. Paul Robinson is first-choice full-back. It's not a good team. But I think the thing about Fulham for me is like they are capable of playing good football. Blackburn are capable of playing good football, but they're also capable of looking incredibly weak and badly organised and making bad decisions. And I think I worry for Fulham this year.
I actually think, because I mean, we sort of brushed off the Europa League there, and I actually know that certainly all the people I know who follow Fulham are going to be genuinely pretty upset about going out of the Europa League.
Martin Yeo was furious, didn't he?
I mean, it was a big deal for I think for their fans. The Europa League has been great fun, and they've really enjoyed it. And I think at the way the group was set up and the way that game was set up even before kickoff, and then obviously once they're 2-0 up, they thought it was going to turn to something more. Having said all that, I personally think that having gone out of that's going to now prove a good thing for them, because they've already played 14 games in that competition. And you think about that, how many games you play over the course of a year. Like, that's ridiculous to have played 14 games on top of your existing schedule already. And so I think that now that they're out of that, you may find their league form picks up a little bit, because they're not going to have to worry about playing quite so often.
Now, elsewhere, Stoke, who are still in the Europa League, are at Wolves. Newcastle host Swansea. Newcastle looking to end a recent slump in results.
That's not really a slump, though, is it?
It is a bit. They got beaten by Chelsea. Then they let four in against Norwich.
They've got a very small squad, Newcastle, and I think the more injuries that pile up over the season is going to really affect them, which is why it's so important they've got all those points early on, because they're not probably going to be in any danger at the bottom.
But Norwich had the ability to go very direct against Newcastle. I'm not sure that every team has that ability. I'm not sure that Swansea, they don't play that way. I'm not sure they'll pose the same threat to that patched up defense.
Stephen Taylor's a huge loss for Newcastle. He's been, he has been holding things together and taking them all out on jollies, paintballing and stuff. So maybe they won't have as much fun anymore,
Yeah. What about Aston Villa Liverpool, Greg?
I can't see anything other than a Liverpool win, providing Liverpool don't start with Andy Carroll in the team. I've not been impressed by Aston Villa in any of the matches I've seen them this season. They've been very negative. The mood at Villa Park just hasn't taken off. Probably, they've got a former Birmingham manager there, and Alex McLeish hasn't really done anything to suggest he's going to try and get Villa playing, a bit more positive football.
All right.
What's your take on Liverpool's top four credentials at the minute?
I think there's still a possibility Liverpool can finish in the top four, but I just think the top four is harder to break into than it has been in the recent past. I mean, you've got the likes of City are now in there, who they're probably going to win the title. Manchester United are very strong, Arsenal are strong, Chelsea are strong, Spurs are playing probably as well as anyone other than City, or as well as City.
Essentially.
Well, essentially, if Liverpool finish in the same position or a position above they did last season, if they finish fifth, then it's progress, and the top four has got to be a target. And I said they would probably get that at the beginning of the season. And that was before Spurs made some, kept Modric and brought in Adebayor and were playing as well as they have. And they're the team that have kind of mixed it up for me and look very good.
All right. Well, let's finish off then with Spurs, who are level on points with Chelsea. So they're right up there. And with a game in hand, of course, they host Sunderland. I was going to make a joke about it. Let's hope things don't go badly against the Black Cats, so they'll all be texting abuse to Ryan O'Neill. But the thing is... But here's another suggestion. This is the story about how all the Spurs fans had a go at Sir Chris Hoy, the track cyclist, because Chris Hoy's refereeing left a lot to be desired, they felt, at the Britannia. But here's Smithy saying, hang on a second, he reckons it was all Sir Chris Hoy's PR company. I'm not going to say their name, because that's the whole point, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Their blurb includes the following I was about to say the name again. Yeah, stunts get noticed and reported. And says Smithy, it's not a great leap of imagination to realise it was Chris Hoy's people, not Spurs fans, who confused the referee with the cyclist. To remind everybody, no doubt, that Chris is out there despite not making Sports Personality of the Year. It was a stroke of PR genius to associate Hoy with Tottenham. When's the last time he trended on Twitter? Which he was doing. And Smithy says he spent at least an hour looking for the alleged abuse that Chris Hoy suffered. He couldn't find any. All he found was lots of people criticising Spurs fans.
Are you Nick Davies in disguise, Smithy?
Yeah, are you?
There's a point to that, because I look at Chris Hoy and think, there's that guy off the Kellogg's advert.
Great. Says more about Chris Hoy than it does about him.
He's won 4 gold medals. Oh, there he is, that Kellogg's guy.
Yeah.
Well, you know, he's almost as famous as the, what's that, Tiger? Tony the Tiger.
Yeah. Well, Greg, really I have Tony to say that, Sir Chris Hoy is one of the most remarkable athletes this nation's produced.
I know he is, but I'm just saying, but the nature of track cycling is that, unlike the Tour de France or something, you're not out there and you're not in the media as often. So yeah, there probably is something to that.
You think there is? You're willing to finger him for?
I'm not saying I'm willing to do that.
For framing an entire club's support.
But I'm just saying that as a conspiracy theory goes, it has a certain.
It's not a bad conspiracy theory.
What?
Hand back that gong.
Yes. All right, Spurs are playing Sunderland, which you'd think would be a fairly safe home game for them, given Sunderland's record, except the O'Neill factor.
Yeah, the O'Neill factor. I'm not overly convinced about that, given that if Seb Larsson hadn't missed that penalty last weekend, there would have been no O'Neill factor. I do think there was a huge slice of luck involved with the O'Neill factor. And to have that against a much better team at Spurs, for second game on the bounce is going to be highly unlikely. I think, it might take effect over time, but maybe not against Spurs this weekend.
Luck is one of the most important qualities a general can have, as Napoleon pointed out. But they have changed the way they play, haven't they, Sunderland? And there is a new belief by the looks of the scenes at the end of the stadium,
I think there'll be belief. I think they'll probably play quite compact, look to play on the counter.
I thought they were meant to be all about width. Oh, you mean compact, kind of back to front?
Yeah, compact back to front, and look to use that width on the rare opportunities when they get a hold of possession.
Anyway, that's it for today's Football Week.
Can I throw in one more thing before
Please
we go?
Please do.
I should have really mentioned with the Itty stuff earlier, but I was wondering if we were going to get onto Europa League and Celtic.
Oh, yeah.
Because Celtic are playing Udinese.
That's true.
And that was going to allow me to segue onto this magical predicting cat that has been stealing headlines in Italy. Fastidious Cat, who is a white cat whose owner decided to start filming it a while ago, and it became a bit of an internet thing that it was just to hit this cat doing stuff at home. But in the last few weeks, he's had it start predicting Udinese games, and it's got 4 out of 4 in a row, which is getting on for Paul the Octopus type levels. And he's predicted an Udinese win tonight over Celtic. So by the time this podcast goes out, we'll know whether or not this is a real psychic cat or just a fake.
He has a feline for the results.
He certainly does.
Yeah. I was going to suggest one of the any other business thing. I don't know if I can just quickly say it. I went to a party last weekend. It was a 1980s party. I took a shoot annual 1988. I wore Puma King football boots because I didn't really have anything else that was
retro.
Is this
a true story, Greg?
Yes, no, it is. It is. And I wore Puma King moulded football boots to the party, when I'm looking sporty. And we played a game which I invented called Puma King Spin. On the dance floor, a pair of Puma King moulded football boots are brilliant for spinning round in. And the record was 4 revolutions before falling over. So if anybody goes to a party over Christmas, any listeners, wear a pair of Puma King Mouldies and see if you can spin more than 4 times.
All right, post your results up on the message board.
Did Puma King have the same PR company as Chris Hoy or something? What's going on here?
Well, wear a pair of Copa Mundial, Adidas, that is.
Really?
Yeah. If you want. I'm sure
it has to be a
moulded
football boot.
Yeah, a moulded football boot on the heel, and you can spin round incredibly fast. It's brilliant.
Wow.
Yeah, and if you can, to an 80s hit like Gold.
I'm going with You Spin Me Round by Dead or Alive.
When the chorus kicks in.
Oh, Gold, you're
saying.
Yeah,
yeah, so right. Gold, Spandau Ballet, when that kicks in, then you go for it, that kind of thing. So,
right, yeah. Greg. Next time, or if somebody filmed you doing this, please post it in.
Okay.
I'd love to. Here's another thing we never mentioned, but we're not going to. Napoli-Roma. Napoli-Roma this weekend.
Yeah.
Derby of the South.
Yeah, it's a huge game. Is that and obviously the Lazio-Udinese game.
Well, I said that one.
Hey, we did. Yeah.
We'll have to talk about that on Monday because people are packing up their headphones. They're putting away their flanges and they're generally getting ready to return to the real world. Many thanks then, guest producer Matt Hill, to Greg Ruffley, Paul McKinnon and Paolo Bandini, and of course you, the listener. Have a super weekend. There will be an award-winning pay-per-view on Friday, but otherwise we'll be back on the Monday. Have a great weekend. Bye-bye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.